Science is a process. It's a tool that we use to understand the world around us. And so to hear the science within the music, I'm not sure if that's what I was actually hearing. I felt when I first heard the music was I get a real sense of the folly of this really dumb experiment that we're conducting at the moment with our planet.
The ocean's chemistry, its crashing waves, and the tiniest of its inhabitants, all wrought on a stave. Today, the ocean as a nexus between the arts and the sciences. Anne Jones with you, and this is Off Track on RN. So how do you tell the story of the ocean in music, especially when your version of the ocean story is about its chemistry, as in the case of Nick Roden, or about phytoplankton in the case of Rob Johnson? Both of these men were writing PhDs a couple of years ago when they were awarded a scholarship by the organisation Lynchpin. Headed by Sue Anderson, Lynchpin aims to encourage scientists to articulate their science to communicators who work in a different genre, and in this case, that genre was classical composition. The two students were paired with a classical composer, and they talked at length over a number of years about their research, and the composer was then tasked with writing a symphony of the ocean. Ex Oceano. The composer was Matthew Dewey.
I think the question is, what does music express? It's my view that music expresses emotion. That's what music does well. It doesn't express academic or intellectual concepts. It doesn't. I mean, you can try and illustrate them in sort of figurative ways, but music expresses emotion. So the moment that music sprung into my mind was the moment that I started to hear the emotion in the voice. And there's a lot of emotion in the voice of these scientists because they've dedicated their life to this. This is such a deep concern for them that they want to spend all their time working in this area, discovering more, discovering why, discovering what we can do to stem this, you know, radical change in our environment. It starts with very low strings. We're getting a sense of something that's ancient and massive, and the story isn't a happy one.
What do I see when I look to the blue horizon? There is only one answer. Life. Ninth of May, 2013. Robert Johnson for Lynchpin. I'm going to tell you the story of our oceans. Not the water you see lapping at the coastline. Perhaps blurring past your car window as you go driving along. I'm guessing that's what you think of when you think of the ocean. Well, what you see from your car window is just the beginning. The true ocean lies over the blue horizon.
What is the ocean? Actually, it forms a critical role in providing us with the air that we breathe, and in fact, life itself. My name is Nick Roden. I am a PhD student at the University of Tasmania and CSIRO. life evolved and started in the ocean some 3.5 billion years ago. It covers over 70% of our planet. It plays a very important role in terms of regulating our climate and also providing us with valuable resources such as protein and fish, of course. Perhaps one thing that many people don't realise is that it actually provides half the air that we breathe. 50% of the oxygen that's in our atmosphere comes from the ocean. It comes from phytoplankton that drift in the ocean. So phyto meaning plant-like and plankton meaning drifters. The Southern Ocean is an enormous expanse of water. It has the only circumpolar current in the world. It's actually the biggest ocean current in the world. So it extends from the surface right down to the bottom of the ocean, which is, you know, in some places over 5 kilometres deep. The Southern Ocean is important because it ventilates deep water to the surface, and it also transports surface water back down to the deep again. This interaction with the atmosphere causes this transfer of gases and heat from the ocean depth to the surface and back down again. This is an incredibly important process as far as climate is concerned because it traps away carbon dioxide and these gases to the deep ocean where they can actually remain for up to 1,000 or so years in some places. So since the start of the Industrial Revolution, the ocean has actually absorbed about 25% of our carbon dioxide emissions. In one sense, it's doing us a really big favour by reducing the severity of global warming by taking up this greenhouse gas. But there's an unfortunate flip side to that, and that is that when carbon dioxide dissolves in water, it creates a weak acid and increases the concentration of hydrogen ions in seawater, and so therefore it decreases the pH. And so we call this ocean acidification.
We need to understand that there is a natural variation in our Earth, and that its climate cycle has been dancing to its own tune long before we started to fiddle with things. The world's oceans have seen hot and cold temperatures over the last 4.5 billion years. The last high CO2 period gradually developed over millions of years. We see this very clearly in the Antarctic ice core records. But the high CO2 period we're developing now has happened in only the last 100 years or so. This is a much more rapid change than our climate is used to, so much so that it's changing the ocean's chemistry faster than we've ever seen before.
Now, this is causing a problem for many marine organisms that live in the ocean. It affects how cells function, and it also affects the ability of certain creatures, marine organisms, to create calcium carbonate structures or shells. So an example of some of these guys are corals and mollusks. And so if we keep pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, the ocean will absorb it. And it reaches a certain point whereby these waters actually become corrosive to these organisms, so whereby the shells will actually start to dissolve. And this is a big concern for us at the moment. Not just chemical changes, I should say, as well, there's also physical changes. In the last 50 years, over 90% of the heat energy that's been trapped in the Earth's system has ended up in the ocean. So when we're talking about global warming, we actually really should be talking about ocean warming. There's all these processes that are hitting the ocean ecosystem. It's just sort of been battered from all sides.
The oceans are so vast. You know, you're seeing birds, you're seeing the animals in the ocean, you're seeing the different colours of it, the strength of it, and the ferocity and the beauty, and you know, just everything. And by the time we get to a certain point where we've gone, okay, well, that's the ocean, that's sort of what's around us, this is the role it plays, we get to this moment towards the end where we have this relentless drumming rhythm. And that is describing human interaction. Mechanical Soviet little drive that is us driving towards a certain destination and leaves us with a sense of goodness me, what have we got ourselves into?
On Off Track today, you're hearing the music and voice of Matthew Dewey, composer, and of Nick Roden, a PhD student in oceanography. And this is Rob Johnson, who has since finished his PhD.
The ocean covers around 71% of the planet's surface. The ocean connects all things. It is the thread that binds the web of life together. If the ocean forms the thread that connects all the systems, then the phytoplankton is the fundamental fabric of the whole system. They even generate the smell of the sea.
Always just sort of assume that it was the trees and the plants on land that gave us the air we breathe. But in actual fact, the ocean is our second lung in a very real sense. And scale. So scale is so important when we're talking about the ocean. It's usually on the very big scale, the very small scale where things happen. So if you look out of your window at the ocean, you know, you'll see waves and you'll see wind, but you won't fully appreciate just what it is that the ocean does for us until you can put it into the perspective of the very small or the very large. The very small is one thing that I've come to appreciate, and that's when I first looked down a microscope at a tiny drop of water, and then all of a sudden this whole new world was sort of opened up to me. Yeah, the phytoplankton. They're absolutely incredible. Phyto meaning plant-like and plankton meaning drifters.
They are at the mercy of the currents. But many phytoplankton use this to their advantage by drifting vast distances and moving around the globe. Phytoplankton also form food for many small grazing animals like pteropods and krill. These are then preyed upon by larger organisms, and that energy is transferred up and up through the food chain. Eventually, the energy that the phytoplankton captured with the help of the sun is transferred all the way through to us. We breathe the oxygen the phytoplankton produce, we eat the fish the phytoplankton feed, we run our cars on the fossilized remains of their dead bodies. We even build our houses with calcium carbonate cement that is derived from the chalk skeletons of particular phytoplankton.
You can't actually see them with the naked eye, but you can actually see them from space, which is just incredible. You can actually see these vast blooms of phytoplankton that sort of drift and swirl around in the ocean current. So these are the organisms that give us half the air that we breathe, and they also transport and lock up carbon in their structures, and in some cases transport this carbon down to the deep ocean, where it can be, in special circumstances, locked away and buried in the sediments. So they're incredibly important, both as an energy source, but also as a form of carbon sequestration and also producing the air that we breathe.
What will happen to the phytoplankton as the ocean becomes more acidic?
At the moment, what we're seeing in experiments is that the response is varied amongst different species. So there's a chance there that some species will be able to adapt more easily than others to the changes that we're going to subject them to. But there are certainly some organisms that aren't going to do as well, and these are most likely going to be the calcifiers. They're the species that lay down calcium carbonate structures. And coccolithophores, which are these microscopic phytoplankton, the ones that mostly make up these enormous, spectacular blooms that we see from space, these are one species that lay down this sort of form of calcium carbonate, which may struggle under future scenarios as far as ocean chemistry is concerned. So if we keep putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the ocean will continue to absorb it, and there'll eventually become a tipping point or a horizon whereby this calcium carbonate will actually start to dissolve back into the water column. It's the ocean's attempt to maintain an equilibrium or a chemical balance. From a chemical standpoint, the ocean doesn't care too much about the life that's happening in it. It wants to maintain this balance. And it will do so to the detriment of some of these organisms. And we're actually causing this change, and that's a really big concern.
On RN, you're listening to Off Track. My name is Anne Jones, and we've got a departure from our normal adventures in the outdoors. Today, it's all about the love of the ocean. We're hearing from three people behind Ex Oceano, a symphony in four parts about the ocean. We've been listening to Nick Roden and Rob Johnson talk about part of their research topics for their PhDs, the tiny phytoplankton which floats about in the ocean and photosynthesizes, and also the ocean's chemistry and just how much it's changing.
It's a love letter to someone or something that you know you're going to lose, but you don't want to lose. I think this is the most important message of this piece. You know, if this symphony is anything, it's a love letter to the world that, you know, in some ways, it's too late. We'd have to have, you know, the political will and the universal understanding and any, you know, and the desire to implement grand change to our policies and the way we live now. Clearly we don't. And therefore the world will change. And there's, in some ways, nothing we can do about that. And so this is a love letter to the world and the oceans and the world as it stands. Because we know it's not going to be like this ever again.
You know, science is a process. It's a tool that we use to understand the world around us. And so to hear the science within the music I'm not sure if that's what I was actually hearing. I think I was perhaps feeling my own emotions and also that of Robert's coming back to us in this musical form. So what I felt when I first heard the music was quite varied. I get a real sense of the folly of this really dumb experiment that we're conducting at the moment with our planet, whereby we're putting all this carbon dioxide, all these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
The root of the matter is that the world is changing and we're making it change faster. It always changes. It never reaches equilibrium. So there's constantly push and pull factors that are changing the world. But, you know, the problem is that the human race, through its actions and through the technologies that it uses and the way we interact with the world is changing the environment around us in a way that, you know, might not, or is, you know, it might be impossible to rectify. It took a long time to clarify, from all these, vast amounts of specific information that they were able to reel off, exactly what their concerns were, and they lie quite deep. And so, really, the story of this symphony and this process is about communicating science, but communicating the emotion behind what these scientists who know what's going on are feeling.
There's also a sense of love as well that comes through in the music. And I think a lot of scientists would probably feel that, we don't spend months on end out at sea or even years sometimes studying these things unless we actually really care about it.
It was a very confronting process for me and for them, because it's easy to hide behind detail, but when you get them to stand back and say, okay, but what does that mean? Why do we care about the way that phytoplankton react or to a change in their environment, or why do we care about the temperature or the carbon level in the ocean or all these things? Why do we care about that? And when you stand far enough away from the detail, you get to some pretty scary moments and some scary thoughts. And that's where people start to talk about, well, we're afraid of losing, this astonishing place around us, this world that we live in, and it never being the same. Had to take it to a place. This is the final movement, jumps around emotionally a lot. There's an urgency to it, and there's a sense of closing to, or closing in on a point, whether that be a tipping point or whatever. And so I build it, and there's this sort of growing anxiety towards the end that the orchestra can't grow any greater You know, the sound can't be any bigger than it is right there. I need to leave this open. I can't resolve this. In musical terms, it's open intervals. It's I don't specify a kind of median sonority, so there's no kind of major or minor sense. It's not playing around with the major minor simultaneous thing or anything like that. It gets to a point where it's open. The very last moment is a moment of reflection where the orchestra is almost a bell, and it just opens out and lets the sound disappear off. It's saying, who knows, what's next? This is just, we're waiting now. We're waiting to see.
This music doesn't replace science. It just expresses it differently. And importantly, it expresses the humanness of science. That is, scientific exploration is a human endeavour, and each of those people has their own driver and their own connection to the topic. Matthew Dewey is the composer of Ex Oceano, commissioned by Lynchpin. The symphony was based off the science and also the conversations between the composer and the researchers Nick Roden, who you heard in an interview with me, and Rob Johnson, who you heard in sections of a written testimony titled The Science Score. More information at the website abc.net.au/rn/offtrack. And that's the name of the show, Off Track on RN. And I'm Anne Jones. I'll be right here at the same time next week, ready to take you somewhere else.